All right. Our next case for this morning is Abbott against Lockheed Martin Corporation, 1237-36. We'll hear from Mr. Wolf.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court, Michael Wolf for the plaintiff's appellants in this case. In Spano, this Court held that an ERISA fiduciary breach class action challenging a planned investment option must be limited to those participants who are harmed by the claimed fiduciary breach. This Court has also held that the class definition must be readily discernible, clear, and precise. The only way to clearly and precisely define the class of participants who suffered harm from an imprudent investment option is to incorporate in the class definition the method for measuring plan losses under ERISA Section 409A.
So could I ask you, Mr. Wolf, if this is like normal class actions, this method, comparing it to the Hewler First Source Index, is a way of achieving class definition, but it doesn't resolve any merits issues, does it?
Correct, Your Honor. It does not resolve any merits issues because all it does is determine under Section 409A what is the prudent alternative by which plan losses would be measured. The Court still has to determine at trial, in this case, since we're past the summary judgment stage, whether the defendants engaged in a prudent process in coming to their decision as to the management of the stable value fund. The
and
Court
there could even be some, I mean, if somebody wanted to try to introduce it to the Court, some better measure of prudence. Is that possible?
Sure. As to the measure of prudence, that will be a separate issue that's highly disputed, and the defendants also could argue for a different loss measure. So they could say instead of the Hewler Index, it should be something else, and then the Court at some point decides what is the prudent alternative by which we're going to calculate plan losses that the defendant fiduciaries must make good to the plan under Section 409A. So, yes, that can all be done. Now, the District Court rejected that definition for four reasons that are clearly erroneous and require reversal. So the first one, as Your Honor touched upon, was that the District Court believed it presumes liability on the part of the defendants, but it does not because this is just the loss measure under Section 409A and not the proof of breach of fiduciary duty under Section 1104A.
I don't see why that would presume liability any more than a class definition of women who took DES who've been harmed. Obviously, all of that's subject to proof.
I agree, Your Honor. And so, and I believe then that the District Court clearly erred in ruling in that respect, that it does predetermine liability. The Court also said that, well, some participants may not have invested in a stable value fund that provided the kind of performance of the Hewler Index type stable value funds. But that's not the proper standard by which to determine the prudent alternative for measuring losses under Section 409A. And it also would be an impossible standard because we can't go back in time and say, all right, if it was virtually the exact same fund but it just provided higher returns, is there any participant out there who would have chosen not to invest it? It's an impossible calculation, and it's asking too much for this sort of standard. So the District Court clearly erred on that point also. The Court was concerned that some participants' investments in the stable value fund, as managed by the defendants, may have outperformed the Hewler Index. But there's absolutely no evidence of that.
And I was going to say, is there any evidence in this phase of the proceedings as opposed to earlier phases pre-Spano about internal conflicts within the class?
None whatsoever, Your Honor. Now, the defendants have an expert who says, well, it could be that the stable value fund managed the way plaintiffs say it should have been managed could have been more risky, and so some participants could have not wanted it to be run that way, but there's absolutely no evidence of that. And as the Court has held in Cohen versus PIMCO and in the Johnson versus Meritor case, it's the defendant's obligation to come up with actual evidence of that, and they certainly could have. They have the name of every single participant who invested in this fund. They have the daily transactional data for every participant who invested in this fund. And they also have the Hewler Index numbers. They can determine if, in fact, there is any participant out there who, in fact, did better in the defendant's stable value fund than they would have in the Hewler Index. We believe that that doesn't exist, but they're the ones who could have come forth with that evidence and had the obligation to come forth with that evidence to show that there was a conflict of interest among this class that provided an insuperable bar to class certification.
So what relevance is the fact that under the theory that this lawsuit is proceeding under, relief goes right into the plan anyway, doesn't go to the individuals, right?
Correct, Your Honor. Although the way that ERISA is structured is that the breaching fiduciaries have to make good the losses to the plan, as well as any profits that they gain from the use of plan assets. But then the fiduciaries are going to have to allocate that to individual participant accounts, most likely, unless there's a good reason not to, for instance, in recovery of excessive fees. So those participants were, by defining the class to include only those who were harmed, were kind of predetermining, all right, here's how the allocation is going to work out. So that the class includes those individuals whose individual accounts will receive the distribution of the recovered plan loss. And so in that way, the class definition complies with the court's statement in Simmer versus Rios that the class ensure that those actually harmed by defendant's wrongful conduct will be the recipients of the relief eventually provided.
So before you go any further, I want you to tell me more about Mr. DeMartini, Lloyd DeMartini, because your opponents have asserted that none of the original named plaintiffs fell within this more narrowed class definition that has that's before us now. And it appears to me that Mr. DeMartini does, but perhaps you can tell me.
Well, we believe Mr. DeMartini does, and the problem, so they raise this in terms of a standing issue. Right. Mr. DeMartini was invested in Stable Value Fund. He claimed that he suffered losses. That's enough to satisfy standing. Now, what we don't have for Mr. DeMartini invested in a short period of time in the latter part of the class period in a calendar year in which the Stable Value Fund outperformed the Hewler Index, taking the whole calendar year perspective. We did not have the evidence for Mr. DeMartini to prove specifically, with expert witness testimony, as we had in, for everyone else, that in fact he did suffer a loss relative to the Hewler Index. But if defendants are going to say, well, no, he gained relative to the Hewler Index, they had all of his daily transactional data. They could have brought that evidence into court and said he doesn't qualify. For class certification purposes, as this court has held, it's very important that the class representative clearly be an adequate representative of the class so that everybody is adequately represented and res judicata principles will then come into play. Because it's not exactly clear that Mr. DeMartini suffered a loss in this, and to avoid the problem of having to argue why under the scant evidence he does, we go with Mr. Ketterer instead, who indisputably did suffer losses.
Right. So actually what we have is cascading named class representatives. We start out with a bunch of representatives under the original class who include Mr. DeMartini. The class then has a legal existence, if you will, because it's been certified. The class is then narrowed, but at that point Mr. Ketterer comes in. So there's always been a named class representative who has a stake in the action.
Yes, Your Honor, exactly. And this class was originally certified under the pre-Spano jurisprudence as a plan-wide class so that any participant in the plan would have the right to collect the plan's losses, recover it for the plan, and get it in the plan. And then the court's decision in Spano said, no, when you're talking about particular funds or being imprudent or particular aspects that don't affect every participant, it needs to be narrowed in that way. And so that's why on remand, to comply with those standards, things were adjusted, specific classes were defined to match up the claims that survived summary judgment, and then the best representatives under the Spano jurisprudence were found.
Right.
The fourth basis of the district court's rejection of the Stable Value Fund class was the court's belief that it could not provisionally use the damages theory as a means of defining those participants who suffered harm from the claim fiduciary breach. And that's just erroneous under Rule 23C1C itself, since the class certification order can be modified at any time before final judgment. It's an inherently tentative order, and it needs to adjust as the case flows along and things get proved up. So the court's, and I believe the court's belief that it couldn't provisionally say, well, this is the loss measure for now, I think that may have been wrapped up in its belief that it, that also predetermines the liability of the defendants. And so, since that's in error, and it's clear that the class certification order is inherently tentative and can be modified at any time, if, as we get into the merits, the court determines, well, there's a different, there's a better way or an appropriate way to measure plan losses, then the class can be modified at that time to comply with the evidence. Because the four bases for the court's decision in rejecting the stable value fund class are clearly erroneous, the rejection of this stable value fund class should be reversed. And I would also point out that the company stock fund class that was certified also had the same similar technique of using the prudent alternative as the means to define the class of harm participants. So we would ask that the order be reversed and that the class be certified as requested by plaintiffs.
All right. You can save the rest of your time for rebuttal if you wish.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Netter.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, Brian Netter for the defendants. Pursuant to this Court's decision in Spano and the Supreme Court's decisions in Walmart and Comcast, the decision whether to certify a class turns on the precise contours of the underlying claim that the plaintiffs present and the definition of the class they propose. Now, based on the theory of relief that plaintiffs have advanced under the Stable Value Fund and the class definition that they provide to support that class, certification as the Stable Value Fund is improper for four reasons. First, plaintiff's theory is a theory that failed on the merits, as the district court found in its decision on summary judgment, and restated again in its decision on class certification.
What do you mean on summary judgment? There's the district court has granted summary judgment rejecting Lockheed's position, saying there need to be more proceeding. I mean, not rejecting ultimately, but.
Your Honor, it's entirely common for a district court to deny summary judgment while essentially narrowing the claims. Now, if we look back to the First Amendment or the Second Amendment complaint, the operative complaint in this case, the lead allegation articulated by plaintiffs is that the label of the Stable Value Fund was inconsistent with the manner in which the fund.
Well, no, they argue throughout that this is an imprudent management case, and the district court, I think, so understood it, but was concerned, I think, actually wrongly so, this is the way class definitions work, that by putting as a placeholder this Hewler source, this Hewler index, that it was somehow prejudging the merits, which it certainly isn't. C1 capital C says you can alter or amend class definition at any time before final judgment. It's inherently a way of capturing those who have been adversely affected, allegedly. I mean, you could put the word alleged every other word, but I just don't see that that's a problem at all.
Well, let me explain, Your Honor, why we think that the plaintiffs are stating a misrepresentation claim and not an imprudence claim.
But they say, why should we accept your characterization of this when they say they're bringing an imprudence claim?
Well, because the imprudence claim that they purport to be advancing is, in fact, a misrepresentation claim. So obviously we can defer to the plaintiff's manner of articulating their claim. They're entitled to file a complaint. But whether that theory that they have articulated counts as misrepresentation or imprudence is a matter for the court to decide. So
that imprudence would have to do with the way the balance between different kinds of investments was achieved, and I think comparing the way this plan was managed to the way many other plans were, looking at expert testimony, for you to try to twist their case into just you called it a stable value plan and it wasn't really stable, you know, isn't fair, I don't think. That's not what they're saying.
Well, Your Honor, I think that is what they're saying. And here's the test where under we think one can divide an imprudence claim from a misrepresentation claim. If a plaintiff's challenge to a fund would exist regardless of any of the plan disclosures, well, that's an imprudent management claim. But if the claim depends on the way in which the fund is described, well, that is a misrepresentation claim. And in this case,
I think their claim meets your first test. It would exist no matter what you called it.
Well, with respect, Your Honor, even as plaintiffs describe their claim in the opening pages of their brief before this court, they speak in terms of what a prudent, quote-unquote, stable value fund would look like, which is necessarily presupposing.
How it would be managed. You know, it's a process. It's not a point in time.
Well, that's correct, Your Honor. But our point is that plaintiffs or the plan participants don't have some abstract right to a stable value fund.
No, they have an abstract right under ERISA to prudent management by the fiduciary of the plan.
Oh, exactly. And our position is that plaintiffs would be entitled to press a claim in which they say an investment in money market assets is imprudent because there's this option, there's this new product called the stable value fund. But that's not the theory that they've articulated because, you know, frankly, half of the 401k plans in America have money market funds.
Well, this says, you know, I'm looking at page 5. They say plaintiffs contend Lockheed allocated an imprudently excessive amount of the SVP to short-term money market investments, which provide minimal yields and therefore caused it to provide far lower returns, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, I feel like I could go through the whole brief and cite examples of this.
Well, you could, Your Honor. And there are also ample examples in the brief of circumstances in which plaintiffs discuss what a typical stable value fund would look like. And from our perspective, they wouldn't be raising this claim if this were called the Lockheed Martin Short-Term Investment Fund. They've been talking throughout the case about how it's a misrepresentation, how it was false advertising.
Well, and these short-term investment funds tend to have money market investments, lower risk, and don't resemble stable value funds, right?
Well, I mean, it depends on what one understands a stable value fund to be, and that's the critical point here, that absent any evidence that any plan participant in this entire class knew what a stable value fund as an investment professional might understand it to be, one would have to look at the plan disclosures. And in this case, we submitted a supplemental appendix that provides the one-page description of the stable value fund, which is explicit as to the assets that would be that would appear in the stable value fund, and the proportions, indicating at one point that 2% of the stable value fund was comprised of these guaranteed investment contracts. So this goes back to our point that if this were called the short-term investment fund and plaintiffs had this disclosure, well, they would be limited to the claim that any short-term investment fund is necessarily imprudent.
I don't think so. I mean, you know, we have been careful in these ERISA cases to say, you know, if you just had labeled this, you know, the Lockheed Reckless Investment Fund or something like that, that wouldn't satisfy ERISA. You have a fiduciary, or the plans, you know, I don't mean you personally, have a fiduciary responsibility to manage other people's assets in a responsible way. And whether that would be proven or not in this case is certainly long down the road. I assume that Lockheed and the plans would give a vigorous defense of their management of these funds. But the plaintiffs are alleging that they were imprudently managed. They have a class of people who have been defined as those who were harmed by the imprudent management, and the district court has recognized that there needs to be a trial on this point. So I don't see why that isn't the end of the discussion.
Well, there are a few answers to that. And the first is that for determining whether class certification is appropriate, the first question has to be an understanding of whether the plaintiff's claim is typical. And our submission is that to the extent plaintiffs are contending that this fund is imprudent in any respect because of what their expectations of a stable value fund are, well, that's not something that they can establish typicality or adequacy. This would be
that's
a different
how
circumstance.
You're trying to twist it into misrepresentation because that might be in the eye of the beholder. But imprudent management either exists or doesn't exist at a plan-wide level.
Well, that's true. And we've indicated in our brief that if plaintiff's position, and we don't think this is plaintiff's position, is that the investment strategy here, the money market investment strategy, is imprudent, well, that is the type of claim that could conceivably be presented on a class-wide basis.
Well,
now, that isn't the case.
Mr. Wolf when he comes back.
That isn't the case here because plaintiffs don't even have jurisdiction to raise this claim. So I'd like to address, you know, Judge Wood's questions about Lloyd DeMartini. Now, it's apparent from the Supreme Court's and this Court's case law that standing is evaluated at the time the complaint is filed. And if plaintiffs couldn't establish injury in fact as to one of the original named plaintiffs, then this claim should have been dismissed.
But Mr. DeMartini, here's what worries me about your point, and you don't really spend much time talking about Mr. DeMartini, but we don't want to confuse standing with the merits. We don't want to confuse standing with ultimate lack of success, whether because of causation or whether it turns out that somebody who allege that he was injured, wasn't really injured because of times. You know, there are a lot of things we need to be careful about. And I see Mr. DeMartini as certainly in the scope of the people who were participating in this plan at the time the case began. It's not a long period of time, but there's a period of time. And Mr. DeMartini has alleged what he needs to allege. Now, you, it seems to me, want us to have the whole trial on the merits before we can determine his standing. And that's, for all that we have front-loaded so much in class actions at this point in the post-Walmart world, people spend millions of dollars before they even know if they have a case, which arguably isn't the way to run a railroad, but that's not our problem. Mr. DeMartini has made the allegations.
Well, Your Honor, pursuant to the Supreme Court's decision in Lujan, simply alleging that one has injury in fact is not sufficient.
He's alleged that he was injured. He was participating in the stable value plan. He's alleged that the injury was caused by the imprudent management and that it's redressable by having the monies paid back to the plan.
Right. And pursuant to Lujan, he has to establish those points with the level of proof that is required for that stage of the proceedings. Exactly. And this case has proceeded past summary judgment, and we know that Walmart requires a plaintiff to come forward with affirmative proof to establish that he satisfies the requisite standards for class certification. Now, there are two cases from out of the circuit that apply the appropriate test, we think. And this is in the case of stock drop cases. The Sixth Circuit has a decision called Taylor versus KeyCorp. The Eighth Circuit has a decision called Brown versus Medtronic. And in those cases, the court considered a circumstance in which essentially the plaintiff had some periods in which he had gained and some periods in which he had lost based on the artificial inflation of the company's stock. And those courts said that in order to establish standing, one has to actually determine whether or not the plaintiff was injured. And
but
on that,
I just don't see that here. I mean, so Ketterer, you know, various people have losses some of the time, and I think here's where you're embracing this Hewler index, which I'm sure you're going to contest as the appropriate measure of prudence later on. He says he's invested there. He says it was imprudent. Just because you make money, maybe you'd make even more money. I mean, I don't know. You seem to think that is enough to take him out of the class, and I just don't see it.
Well, the Hewler index is the ceiling on the possible injury to plaintiffs that I think they would acknowledge. But the issue here, and plaintiffs acknowledged when they were standing up here, Mr. Wolf said that they couldn't prove it, and it's plaintiffs' burden to prove standing. They essentially try to cast the blame over to Lockheed Martin for not producing evidence. I don't know what that evidence would look like to prove.
The evidence would be Mr. DeMartini's account. It would be very easy for you to produce.
Well, except that the accounts are in the possession of the record keeper, and although Lockheed Martin could potentially acquire that, that's a matter of discovery.
It's a burden of production. Look, there's so much discovery at the class certification stage now. What's a little more?
I mean, essentially, however, the daily returns of the Hewler Index, I don't believe, appear on the record either. And that would certainly be plaintiff's burden to present those. So all we have is the fact that Mr. DeMartini invested in the fund during a year in which there was no injury, as plaintiffs admit. And that's why they didn't submit an expert report to suggest that Mr. DeMartini had injury. And if he didn't have injury, then the introduction of Mr. Ketterer into the case 5 years after the complaint was filed is inadequate to vest the court with jurisdiction under this court's decision in Walters versus Edgar. Now, I would note further that even if we're at a circumstance under Rule 23 in which this court believes that De Bruyne does not foreclose plaintiff's theory on an ongoing basis, and even if this court doesn't agree that plaintiff's claim is a misrepresentation claim, there are still fundamental questions about what the Hewler Index does and how it could possibly identify plan participants who have sustained injury. Toward the end of this court's opinion in Spano, it explains that claims of fiduciary imprudence are not to be examined essentially on a fund-level basis, that because a plan...
That's why it's a piece of evidence as opposed to the be-all and the end-all, but it's not even clear, given the tentative nature of all class definitions, that in the end that's going to be a measure of damages. It might be a measure of damages. I think that what the plaintiffs are claiming is Lockheed is liable for this imprudent management. We don't know if Lockheed imprudently managed at all. It might have been a model manager, for all I know. And we don't know if anybody, DeMartini or anyone else, will be entitled to recovery. There's a final administrative stage of every class action where you actually look at each person's account. That doesn't prevent the class from going forward.
That's certainly true, Your Honor. However, the way in which plaintiffs have chosen to characterize their class definition and the way in which they have chosen to characterize their claim informs whether these proceedings are suitable to proceed on a class-wide basis.
Well, you would agree, would you not, that if there were individual claims brought against the plans, each for imprudent management, and case number one concludes that Lockheed took steps to manage very prudently, and case number two says, no, Lockheed didn't manage prudently, and case number three says, for this number of years it was prudent, and for that number of years it wasn't prudent, that would be a mess, because the managers did whatever they did. They didn't do it individually for each account.
That's true, Your Honor, except that the obligation...
One class action.
The obligation of the plan fiduciaries was to create sufficient investment options such that participants could create an appropriate portfolio.
Right, and so they create the menu and so on. But I'm just saying that the risk of inconsistent standards being imposed is very substantial here. It looks exactly like what the drafters in 1966 were thinking of for B1 class actions.
Your Honor, again, that depends on the underlying nature of the plaintiff's claim. And if, as we think Spano indicates, plaintiff's claim has to be that on the plan level it was unable for them to construct a prudent portfolio, well, then that could depend on the circumstances of the individual plaintiffs. And one could have an imprudent, it could be possible that somebody approaching retirement who needs to have more secure assets would not have the available investment funds. However, somebody who is in his 20s or 30s and who has a more aggressive investment portfolio structure could have entirely prudent options.
Sure, that's true inside the stable value fund. I mean, certainly the person approaching retirement might want to have a mixture, you know, might want a high growth fund or a very prudent fund, or might, you know, depending how much money the person has to play with, they might have a portfolio that includes a number of different funds. But inside the stable value fund, there's one prudent way to manage those things.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that I agree, because the obligation of plan fiduciaries is to create a spectrum of investment options. And because in this...
inside each fund. I mean, you know, you can have you can have company funds, you can have stable value funds, you can have mid-cap funds, you can have all kinds of funds.
Precisely. And a fund that offers multiple bond funds might have different preferences, and reasonably might have different preferences for a stable value fund than a fund for which it's the only bond-type investment option. So I don't think that it's the case that one can look at the stable value fund in isolation and determine whether or not it is prudent. It has to be at the plan level. I note that my time has expired. We would ask the Court to affirm, I'd also like to point out that our last footnote in the brief indicates that even if this Court disagrees with the decision of the District Court, there are remaining issues that would need to be decided on remand.
All right. Thank you very much. Anything further, Mr. Wolf? I'm guessing the answer is yes.
Yes, Your Honor.
The initial standing issue has already been resolved by the District Court, which rejected the defendant's arguments that the plaintiffs did not have standing.
So the question is, as the case gets narrowed, some people who might originally have been encompassed within the class definition might not be encompassed, and indeed aren't, as I understand here, encompassed in the revised definition.
Right, and that has nothing to do with standing, because once standing is established in the case, it exists throughout the case unless there's a change in circumstances, which there weren't here. Ketterer clearly has standing. Standing is a red herring issue in this case. Your Honor was correct that the defendants are trying very hard to mischaracterize this claim as a misrepresentation claim, because we're trying to fit it into the DeBrine case by saying that just because we called it a stable value fund doesn't mean we were wed to a particular way of investing those assets, and we never say that they were. The District Court recognized that and stated in denying summary judgment, as in DeBrine, using the term stable value does not wed the fund to a specific mix of investments. But that does not mean that the fund need not be managed in accordance with plan documents and with care and prudence. And that is what this case is about. There's no question about that. Now, what is the evidence of the imprudence? It comes from the defendant's own 30B6 representative, who said that our fund will not, and I'm quoting here, will not beat inflation by a sufficient margin to provide a meaningful retirement asset. As the District Court recognized, These fiduciaries had grave doubts about the way they were managing this fund, and the evidence so far is that they did nothing about it. And under this court's decision in George versus Kraft Foods, if the fiduciaries know that there's a problem and fail to do anything about it, that's evidence that they have breached their fiduciary duties. And in that case, it was evidence to overcome the district court's grant of a summary judgment. That's what this case is about. It's not about misrepresentation. And frankly, Your Honor, I mean, to quote you, that's the end of the discussion. It's not a misrepresentation claim. It's an imprudence claim, and the class definition was correct.
All right. Thank you. Thank you to both counsels. We will take the case under advisement.